$2.61 more than the national average. $2.61. No justification, period, full stop. They lied to you. They're gaming the system. They raked in billions and billions of dollars of profit, $63 billion in 90 days. So we've got to not just call it out, we've got to do something about it.
Governor Gavin Newsom railing against oil companies yesterday. He wants to claw back some of the profits when gas companies have a windfall, and he's convened a special legislative session to do that. This summer, as we were paying record prices for gas, oil companies were booking huge profits. For example, in just one quarter, Chevron made more than $11 billion in just one quarter. Newsom's plan would penalize oil companies that make more than a yet-to-be-determined profit cap, then return that money to us, the consumers. Oil companies say they're not profiteering. They have to charge more because of California's environmental rules and taxes. And Republicans say Newsom's proposal will only drive up prices at the pump. Joining us to talk more about this is Jeremy White. He covers California politics for Politico. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. Well, the governor says he wants transparency. He wants accountability from these companies. What are the details in his proposal? What is he proposing to do?
We finally did just get some details yesterday, although there are still some details to be filled in. Very basically, if companies are earning more than a yet-to-be-specified margin, then they will be penalized by the state. Those funds would go into a new state fund, which would then go out to people as refunds. So the amounts, who would be eligible, what would constitute too much money, those are all yet to be determined, but fundamentally that's how it would work.
So he's calling this a penalty and not a tax. Why?
Well, I think there is a very clear political benefit for him, which is that a tax requires a two-thirds vote. A penalty only requires a majority. The governor did not concede yesterday that that's what was motivating him. He characterized this as sort of a deterrent that companies will not charge excess amounts to avoid this penalty. But I think if you are purely trying to map out how this might pass the legislature, certainly going from a two-thirds to a majority vote would be a big difference.
Well, so gas prices were up nationwide over the summer, as we all were painfully aware. They were the highest, of course, in California, and the companies blame the state's environmental regulations, its special summer blends that cost more, and they say they're not profiteering. So where is the truth in all this?
I wish I could tell you that I had an unequivocal, clear answer on that, but as you noted, Governor Newsom will say that the state's additional environmental regulations don't explain the excess cost. The companies say, look, we were dealing with a global price spike, and there are various regulations in California that make it more expensive to do business here. I can't say what blend exactly of those things is factoring into these high prices, but it's clear that the governor and other Democrats feel pressure to do something about it. Although, as you said, gas prices are dropping again now, so I think that may remove some of the political urgency that the governor felt when he came out with this plan back in October.
Right. And is it possible that if he succeeds in being able to claw back this money, that the oil companies might just turn around and raise prices again and recapture that profit at the pump?
Certainly seems possible. It's one of the reasons that economists are somewhat skeptical of this concept. It's one that is fairly untested. And again, we just got details yesterday for the first time on how this would work. And some of them have yet to be fleshed out. So I think there are certainly some questions about implementation and how this could be effective.
Right. Like legally, can they force oil companies to agree to a profit? Can they limit the ceiling that oil companies make?
That's a great question. I expect that if something passes, we will see it be contested legally. I wouldn't be surprised if we even see opponents of this contest the definition as a penalty rather than a tax, given that the governor was out there talking about a tax. We've certainly seen court cases before about the difference between a tax and a fee in the legislature, which directly affects the vote threshold. So I think purely aside from the political considerations of passing this now, should it pass, I have no doubt that we will see some legal questions raised.
Okay, I want to switch gears a little bit since we're talking about politics. You raised that word. And I want to talk about the future of one of our Senate seats. Senator Dianne Feinstein is, what, 88 years old now? So Democrats are wondering if she's going to seek re-election in 2024, and she hasn't said whether she will or not, but yet there are people lining up already. So who could possibly run for her seat should she decline to seek re-election?
Well, we saw Congressman Adam Schiff out of Los Angeles publicly declare that he was interested in the seat. I don't think that came as a surprise to anyone, but I think it was notable because he was the first one to really go out there publicly and say it. My sources tell me he also met with Senator Feinstein to tell her, look, this is what I'm thinking, sort of a show of respect. And it's still early. As you noted, Senator Feinstein has not said either way what she intends to do. That said, I think there's a widespread presumption that she is not going to run for another term when she's in her 90s. And so in addition to Adam Schiff, Congresswoman Katie Porter, who represents Orange County and just won a tough re-election campaign, certainly seen as a contender. Congressman Ro Khanna in the Bay Area, a progressive with a district in Silicon Valley where there's, of course, a lot of money floating around, also seen as a contender. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who represents Oakland, has long been seen as somebody who might be appointed should Gavin Newsom appoint somebody if Senator Feinstein resigns. I think she's also taking a look at it in her own right. And, you know, a U.S. Senate seat does not open up that often. So I would fully expect that there would be some more folks getting involved, including potentially a self-funding type, as we saw with Rick Caruso just now in the mayoral race.
Oh, interesting. What about the governor himself? Would he be interested?
You know, I have heard the theory that there's some sort of move in which Senator Feinstein steps down so the governor can appoint himself to the Senate seat. I find that pretty far-fetched. I think the governor enjoys an executive role, and I would say I do not get the sense that the U.S. Senate is the next higher office in his sights. I would put it that way.
All right. Jeremy White covers California politics for Politico. Thanks for joining us again.
Always a pleasure.
The largest higher education strike in U.S. history has now entered its fourth week. Academic workers across the University of California system have been demanding better pay and better benefits like childcare subsidies and also better family leave. A week ago, UC reached a tentative deal with its postdoctoral scholars and academic researchers, but it has yet to reach a deal with 36,000 graduate student workers, so that strike is still going. How grad students make money can be complex and piecemeal, a maze of funding that's even harder to navigate in a high cost of living place like LA or New York. We're going to talk about this now with Brisa Smith Flores. She's a PhD candidate at UCLA, and she also hosts a series of YouTube videos about financial literacy and funding for grad students. Hi, Brisa.
Hi, how are you?
I am well, thank you. Also joining us is Rebecca Given, professor of labor relations at Rutgers in New Jersey and the president of that school's Union of Graduate Workers, Faculty, and Postdocs. Welcome to you, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you too. Okay, Brisa, let's begin with you. You do this on your YouTube channel, but can you briefly explain the different ways grad students can make money? Because it is complicated.
Yes, I think a lot of times when we think about grad funding, especially if you're entering into the PhD, you think automatically you're going to get paid, life is going to be easy, and you're going to do research. But I found out pretty soon that that definitely is not the case. And so using myself as an example, starting as early as my first year, I had to balance having almost 30 hours a week of work, having my own graduate school schedule. I worked in two different departments, one as a teaching assistant, but I was also a financial wellness consultant for the financial wellness program at UCLA. And then I also took out student loans because I was an out-of-state student. There was a big portion of my time where I was working outside jobs outside of the university. So I spent some time working at the Getty Museum, and that is independent of the university system. And you kind of do some of this work under the table. So you are supposed to be capped. At the amount of work that you're allowed to do, I think 30 hours is the cap, 75%. But if you get outside work, if you have any type of grants or funding, they can take that money away from you or they can ask you to pay it back. So there's a high stake of being found out if you don't balance these things correctly or know what are the rules in relation to the grants, the funds, or even the amount of student loans that you ask.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So you can also have a stipend, a fellowship, a grant. It's all very confusing. On top of the fact, so you're working 30 hours a week, on top of the fact that you have to do your coursework too, while you're there in the first place.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. It's really a lot of gymnastics and careful multi-year planning to make sure that you're able to successfully get your PhD done in a timely manner while also having some financial stability as you do so.
Wow. Okay. So that is a lot to wrap our minds around. Rebecca, what do you hear there in Brisa's experience?
I think, unfortunately, her experience is really typical. The funding that is available to graduate students simply doesn't allow them to cover their cost of living. And so for those who have a more typical cost of living, they are going to struggle. And a combination of debt and additional jobs makes the situation really, really untenable.
Right. And if you would, Rebecca, take a step back. And how did the United States get in this position where all of this work is being done by graduate students who are not paid very much when it comes to teaching undergraduates?
Yeah, education, especially public education, has been really systematically underfunded since universities started admitting more Black and brown students, more working class students. And since the students started agitating, it's been written a bit about this UC strike, the history of the UCs going from a basically no tuition model to the current very high tuition model, the lack of state investment. And what it means is that they've squeezed workers. And we used to have a situation where doctoral education was something that led to something like a sure thing of a solid professional career. And now a doctoral degree leads to uncertainty, contingency, maybe the life of an adjunct faculty member.
Brisa, so what are you looking at when you graduate, when you get your PhD in terms of employment?
What a wonderful question. I think the honest response is because of the burnout, the exhaustion that I have from being a graduate student that has worked anywhere from 2 to 4 jobs at a time while doing my own research, I'm not necessarily disillusioned into thinking that a professorship is exactly where I want to go. So the answer is I don't actually know what the end goal is at this point. Now that I've experienced academia and I see how adjuncts, lecturers, junior scholars are treated within academia, the expectation, even the tenure process, it can all add up to this same feeling that I feel as a graduate student. I have applied to postdocs. I have applied to other jobs that are not academic, and I'm always hoping this YouTube thing pops off. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of eggs in a lot of different baskets and hoping for the best, but I'm definitely aware of not just the pay, but also the expectation of labor for your compensation.
Right. So UC would say, look, we provide a lot of benefits that aren't necessarily direct salary, but converted are quite valuable, such as reimbursement for childcare expenses for eligible students, UC paid leave for medical care, UC paid tuition, campus fees, and healthcare remission for some eligible student employees, student housing that is below market rates. And then they point out that, look, these are part-time jobs, so they're being compensated with that in mind.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting way to approach that because a lot of those benefits that they talk about, the key word is for eligible students. Most students are not eligible for those things. Mm. To live on campus below rate is a lottery. I've applied for, if I'm a fifth year, I've applied 4 out of 5 years and only got accepted once. And it was so late in the game that I had already signed a lease for an apartment already. Other things like reimbursement is really rough on graduate students if you don't have the money to begin with. So I think on paper, a lot of that seems like it's helpful, but in application, empirically, it doesn't help graduate students that are already struggling, who already don't have money. In a lot of cases, we don't get our first paycheck until after a month of working. And so there's all of these insecurities that come with, how do I pay rent my first month of working? How do I get to school, pay for parking? And going to UCLA in general is just really expensive. Parking is expensive. Gas is expensive.
LA is expensive.
LA is expensive. And if you don't live in the housing and you're in Westwood, that's an unbelievable amount of money. I live 20 miles away in Van Nuys. So it's, again, on paper seems really useful, but in application, most graduate students don't really benefit from those resources, and the expenses very much outweigh the cost that students are expected to do. And the idea that these are part-time jobs is also kind of a fallacy, in the sense when you count the expectations, how many hours students are expected to work, a lot of us are doing way more than just the expected 10 to 20 hours of work.
Rebecca, is this something that you see in most university settings? Is UC an outlier? How does UC compare to other public universities?
Well, UC is the biggest, so the scale is larger, but the type of problem is pretty widespread at this point. Some universities have made a commitment in the past year or so, mostly I think in response to graduate workers organizing unions. But in general, what the UC system is doing is what most, especially public universities, are doing, which is saying we're going to increase the numbers of undergrads we're teaching, because they are the ones who pay the tuition. And we're going to do that without increasing costs very much by using underpaid labor to teach those students.
So is the answer raising the tuition, or how do we get beyond this?
I think there's a few different paths. One is we need significant new public investment, and I feel confident that the workers would be happy to go with the administrators, to go to the state and to go to the people of the state and say we need to get back to a much, much higher level of public investment in higher education. But the other thing is that all of these universities are making budget choices all the time. They have massively increased, for example, the number of high-level administrators they have. People joke about deans and deanlets and provosts and assistant vice provosts. You know, we can joke about it, but it's really real, what we call the administrative bloat. The priorities, the earmarking of money for massive, massive, shiny new construction projects. These are active decisions, and different decisions could be made with the same pot of money.
And Brisa, this strike doesn't show any signs of ending anytime soon. What do you anticipate?
You know, there's a lot of unknown that comes from this. I do think, as graduate students, when you've spent so much time trying to fight to stay out of poverty, you really don't see the downside to continuing this fight. There's only up. I'm teaching my own independent class in the winter, and if this strike continues, then I won't get to have that professionalization experience. I won't get to make those connections with my wonderful students. And so it impacts us as well. We want to get back teaching. We want to be in these spaces, and we want to share, you know, our knowledge. That's why we're here. We love this process of education and academia, but at the same time, we want to do so without experiencing housing insecurity, risk of starving, being left out. You know, there's a lot at stake for us and our families. And so I think the anticipation is that we're not going to give up, and we're not asking for everything. We're just asking for a little bit more so we can make ends meet more sustainably.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today. Rebecca Given is a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. Brisa Smith-Flores is a PhD candidate at UCLA, and you can find her series on financial literacy for grad students at YouTube. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why cold weather actually does cause more colds. A new study reveals why. We'll have one of the authors of that study next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Your mother is right. You really can catch a cold by being outside in the cold. Finally, scientists have figured out why. It turns out that cold temperatures lower the body's ability to fight off viruses. One of the lead authors of this study is Dr. Benjamin Blyer. He's an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great, thanks. Okay, well, before we get into your study, tell us what happens in our body when we're exposed to a virus that causes either the flu or a cold. How does it enter and infect our bodies?
Yeah, well, it turns out to be a pretty interesting mechanism. So, you know, most of these viruses that cause the common cold or what we would call a respiratory tract infection are inhaled through the nose. And these viruses then find these little receptors or these sticky arms that are there, and they bind to them. And then they get into the cells of our nose and they start to replicate. And that's how the virus starts to spread throughout the body. You know, when we breathe in air, we breathe in about 10,000 liters of air a day. So you can imagine that we're constantly exposed to large volumes of these viruses and bacteria and other things in the environment. So our nose really has to work hard to protect our body from getting infected.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you focused on the nose, and because, as you say, that's where the disease comes into the body, right there in the nose. And how did you conduct your experiment?
We actually took bacteria and we infected the cells of the nose, and we found something very interesting. We found that when the front of the nose, the first part of the body that really sees these bacteria and viruses in the environment, when it detects the presence of these sort of pathogens, these bad bugs, it sets off this big alarm response. And essentially this epic battle starts to occur within the nose, where the cells of the lining of the nose, they release these swarms of what we call vesicles into the nasal mucus. The way that I like to think about it is sort of kicking a hornet's nest. So, you know, the nest is just sitting there, and if you disturb it, all of a sudden these swarms of hornets come out to defend the nest against whatever's attacking it. And so in that study, we found that these vesicles were able to attack the bacteria before they were ever able to get into the body and cause an infection. And then we asked the question, well, does the same thing happen for viruses? And so that's how we conducted this study. We actually infected cells with three different kinds of common cold viruses. And we found that they all really produced the same response, which has sort of three really important components. The first is that when the nose detects a virus, it increases the number of these vesicles or these hornets by 160%. And then inside these little vesicles, these little cells, are these very protective molecules called microRNA that then kill the viruses. So essentially what your nose is able to do is as soon as it sees a virus, it's able to send all of these decoys or these vesicles into the mucus, which then bind the virus and kill it before it ever has a chance to actually infect the cells themselves.
It's
really one of the only parts of the immune system, if you think about it, actually leaves your body to go attack the things in the environment before they can actually get to the cells themselves. So it's pretty amazing.
Okay, so how did you find out that reducing the temperature kills these vesicles, these cells that defend us?
Really, there have never been a real quantitative explanation for this. A lot of people say, well, people gather indoors in the cold months, and that's why people get infected. But in modern society, we know that we're indoors most of the year. So obviously, there's something else going on. And so we asked the simple question, well, now that we know about this novel part of the innate immune system, what happens when we cool it down? And as we know, as I mentioned, the nose breathes in about 10,000 liters of air a day. And so we're very sensitive to changes in external air temperature. The nose sees that cold air and has to also work hard to warm it and humidify it. And so the front of the nose actually gets very cold when we're exposed to cold air. And in our study, we actually looked in live subjects, volunteers, where we put temperature probes inside their nose under cold environments and found a 5 degrees Celsius or 9 degrees Fahrenheit drop in the temperature in the front of their nose. And then what we did was we took that same temperature drop that we saw in live volunteers, and we applied them to our viruses and our cells, and we looked to see what happened. And basically, in all of those different mechanisms that I just described, they were essentially knocked out by about 50%. We saw about 50% less of these vesicles. They had about 50% or up to 75% less of these sticky arms to bind the viruses. And they had about 50% less of this virus-killing microRNA. And so what that meant is when we looked at to see how much virus was growing in the cells, it was about double. So basically what we showed is that just that limited, you know, brief 15-minute exposure to cold air where you get a drop of about that 5 degrees is enough to cut our immune defenses in half.
Does it have to be a specific decline in temperature, or does it have to be an overall a lower temperature? In other words, is it what we're used to, or is it and that changing, or is it just the overall cold temperature? And no matter where you are, if it's at that cold temperature, you're more susceptible to a cold.
Yeah, that's a really fantastic question. And, you know, we weren't able to test sort of all these different parameters and different amounts of drop in temperature. So my suspicion is that that is sort of a spectrum of decline. So if you were only mildly cold, you might have less of a decline in the response. But we didn't directly test that. So, you know, that would be a hypothesis we'd want to look at.
Yeah, because the flu season here in California, where it is much warmer than in New York or anywhere on the East Coast, is terrible. I mean, as many people, I believe, are getting sick here as they are in colder places.
Yeah, well, you know, certainly I think there's a lot of factors that are related to that, you know, including this sort of immune deficit hypothesis that, you know, people haven't been exposed for several years, so their bodies just aren't really ready to fight off these things. So there's a lot of factors at play in any given, you know, area or region.
Right. So that means we need to keep our noses warm.
We need to keep our noses warm. That's right. What it does, it shows us that the nose really is the gateway to the body for a lot of these inhaled viruses. So in the future, when we think about vaccines, there's a lot of work around switching from, you know, these intramuscular vaccines to intranasal vaccines that would generate mucosal immunity, which we think would be important. There are possible, you know, therapies that would mimic exposure to viruses. So the body kind of is already revved up and ready to fight off viruses. And so if we can sort of mimic that with a otherwise non-toxic medication that you just sniff in, well, then maybe we can actually help prevent this in the future.
Right. And then meanwhile, we can just keep our masks on and it'll keep the viruses out and the nose warm.
We assume the masks were working because they were preventing us from actually inhaling the viruses. And I think they did a very good job of that. But also it seems like maybe they're keeping this little blanket of warm air in front of our nose and at least limit that decline in temperature. So I think, I think the masks may be doing more things than we ever thought, actually.
Well, thank you very much. Fascinating study.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Dr. Benjamin Blyer, associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Coming up, Los Angeles comedian Atsuko Okatsuka has her first HBO special, where she talks about a literal intruder at her house and...
I titled this special Intruder because as a immigrant, I felt like one, you know, like I was intruding on another culture, another people.
Atsuko Okatsuka is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In her new HBO special, LA comedian Atsuko Okatsuka tells the story of a home invasion.
I don't want to fight off a scary man. No. I just want to die at a Sephora. Yeah, thank you. You too. Yes. Is that so much to ask for, right? Oh my God, I've done enough in my life. Okay, I immigrated. I learned a language. I even set foot on a yacht once.
Atsuko is originally from Japan, and in her stand-up routine, she talks about her immigration story of being an outsider and even her family's struggles with mental illness. She also talks about being afraid of teenagers. aren't we all? Atsuko Okatsuka joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
It's great to have you. First of all, what's so scary of teenagers?
They're just so confident and they're just so self-aware. And I don't remember being that way.
You were a teenager once.
I was. Yeah, we all were. But I just don't remember being so confident and sure of myself back then. And I didn't feel so secure about myself. It wasn't just the immigration status. I was undocumented. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just felt like everyone could see through me. Everyone could see that about me. Yeah. And so when I meet teenagers today, I'm just like so impressed. It's really a compliment that I'm scared of them.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned you were undocumented. Talk about that. How did you come to the United States and why were you undocumented?
Yeah, so I talk about it a little in the special about mm-hmm. being bamboozled by my grandmother, who is my best friend. But sometimes your best friend lies to you, too.
Yeah. My grandma told me we were coming to the States for a 2-month vacation. Yeah, 2 months, 2-month vacation. Yeah. And then so I packed lightly, you know. And then she had us overstay our tourist visas and we became undocumented and lived in my uncle's garage in hiding for 7 years. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I've been bamboozled before.
So she really said you were just going for a vacation to the United States and we'll be back?
Yeah. You know when people try to protect you by, oh, this is a white lie. You know, she's a kid. Maybe she won't be ready to make such a big move, a permanent move. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But girl, I can count, you know. I can count months.
How old were you?
I was 10 years old. Uh-huh. And so, you know, living in Japan, I think my mom's schizophrenia, her mental illness was sort of, she wasn't doing well there. And so mm-hmm. sometimes you go, I think it's the location. We just need to change locations instead of looking inwards.
Yeah.
So my grandma thought, well, America, I have a son who will let us live in his garage. We should go there. Everyone goes there for a better time, you know.
So you lived in your uncle's garage?
We lived in my uncle's garage, so I came along. You know, as a kid, you don't have a choice. They enrolled me in summer school, and, you know, I started learning English there, and I was like, this is fun. I'll go back to Japan, tell all my friends, show them my new English words. And I never got to do that. I didn't really even get to say bye to my dad, who got left behind in Japan.
Oh, wow. So it was just the three of you, your mom, your grandma, and you.
Three generations of women, yes.
Just in the garage.
In the garage, you know, trying to live life. When things were sad, I would always, like, you know, sing songs, dance, try to entertain. So it was kind of like Grey Gardens. It felt like Grey Gardens, but without all the money, and there were three of us. So that was my upbringing. And then naturally, you know, I think comedy was going to be somewhere near my horizon.
Right. I get that. So, and also dancing. You're also quite a dancer. And how did you marry the two or decide to marry the two?
Yeah. It's, you know, it is hard to marry the two, actually, because, you know, especially since it's stand-up comedy where you're using your words to make people laugh and think and storytell, it's so different than dance, which is no words and expressions. But yeah, you really have to be, I think, like in your body and self-aware, which I wasn't always. Uh-huh. You know, I am sort of a physical performer. I use my eyes to express, you know, even if I'm not moving about a lot on stage, you know, I am always like speaking from my toes. I think a lot of my energy comes from my toes. Hmm. Yeah, every muscle is sort of activated.
That's so interesting. The toes. Like I wouldn't think of that. You're speaking from your toes. And also the feet in general are ignored a lot. People don't really pay attention to their feet.
Yeah, and if you think about breathing, how you breathe, you know, people always remind each other, don't breathe from your chest, you know, breathe from your stomach, right?
Yeah.
And it gives you more energy. It just gives you the full potential of being able to perform. Doing an hour of stand-up comedy is a lot of energy. So speaking from the stomach, you know, using my toes, using my legs, even if I'm just standing there.
So you do a lot of videos on TikTok, and a lot of them involve dancing.
Yes.
And a lot of them involve your grandma.
Yes. Again, great gardens.
Yeah. So when you first started doing these, did you have to convince her to be a part of them?
I would start dancing on my own and posting it online. You know, I was posting videos of me dancing anyway. And then a little before the pandemic, I was doing a video at my grandma's place. And she was like, "What is up with those? Is it fun?" And I was like, "Oh, it's so fun." And she was like, "Well, do you mind if I join?" And I was like, "Are you kidding me? Of course." And so we found her something to do. Some of our videos involve her sort of being my hype person. And So maybe she's playing the drums, but it's with oranges or potatoes. And so it's the potato drums. I was like, "How about I dance and you're my percussionist?" And so she started drumming with the potatoes. And that was one of our first videos that we posted together. And it got shared widely because people were like, "What is this dynamic? What is going on here? Two people in a kitchen. The younger one is shaking her booty. And and I think that's a grandma just, you know, drumming with potatoes on, you know, on a plastic bowl." And she had so much fun. My grandma's been a caretaker most of her life. And so She always put fun later, you know. She was like, "Put it off. It's okay. Mm-hmm. You have fun, you know. I had an intense life so that you can have a less intense one." And it was so cool to see that she was having fun. And then so that became sort of a thing that we like to do as a family. And the world was like, "We like it too." And so we continue to do those for the people.
The people love it. And the people really love the drop challenge that you invented on TikTok. And for the unawares, describe that and how you came up with that idea.
So Beyonce's song Partition has this beautiful bass drop. It just goes, "Whoa, whoa," you know. And when it came out, I was like, "Gosh, that bass drop is so hot and I love it." And it was always in the back of my head because it's not a new song. It had already been out a few years. And my grandma and I were just hanging out in Little Tokyo of Los Angeles, just shopping, grocery shopping. And that song was in my head. And I was like, "Gosh, wouldn't it be so funny if every time the beat dropped, your body dropped too?" It took like 2 minutes to film. And then it became a global sensation. And it helped that it was during the pandemic too, and people really needed cheering up and something they can feel like they were a part of. And so nurses started doing it on their off, you know, when they had 15 minutes in between their next person they had to see. My favorite thing about seeing other people's recreation of it was learning about all these new jobs I didn't know were out there. Because they would do it at their work.
That's so cool. And do you think that changed your career at all? Or, I don't know, put you on a different path or anything like that?
I think so, you know, because it did go viral and a lot more people started following me. And then they would find also my stand-up comedy and they'd be like, "Oh my gosh, she's also a stand-up," you know? And so, yeah, I think it really did. It allowed me to tour because I'd been doing stand-up for 13 years. And when the pandemic hit, I was like, I set up a goal for myself. I said, I want to do an hour of stand-up and tour with it. And I feel more me and more in tune with myself than ever. You know, a lot of us were forced to look more inwards during the pandemic. And I started writing about things I was scared to talk about before, like my mom's schizophrenia, and trying to find the levity in those topics. And then also we had an intruder come to our house. And I was like, I want to talk about this too. And the idea of the intruder, I titled a special intruder because, you know, as a immigrant, I felt like one, you know, like I was intruding on another culture, another people, like, did I fit in? And now there was this intruder coming to our house 3 times in the same day. And so because of the drop challenge and all these other videos, you know, I was able to tour because now I had a bigger fan base that was ready to hear my story and my comedy.
Wow. So let's talk about the intruder. Was he a real intruder?
Yes, he was a real human person. That did resemble my husband.
Was it your husband?
That would be so funny if that's how I found out he had a twin.
And like a soap opera, the evil twin.
Oh, yeah, the evil twin that's like jealous, you know, you just upset. You never talk about me. You never even mention me. And now you're married and I never even got to meet your wife, you know, and so this is how he gets back at us. it was broad daylight. It started at like 1 p.m., kept coming to our house. I've only had an intruder situation one other time in my life, where we were living in the garage, and that was wild. Where, is it okay I go into it?
Yeah, please.
So my mom, my grandma, and I, you know, were sort of cramped in this garage. My uncle had sort of tricked it out for us a little bit. He had there was a shower and a toilet in there, and even like a little kitchen space. So my grandma and I would sleep on the bed, and then my mom would sleep on the floor. And one night, the garage door opened and this man walked in while we were sleeping, and I jumped up, and we, you know, we're all crammed, all our stuff is everywhere, you know, there's a dog, a tiny puppy, and the man walked in, saw how we were living. I jumped up, I was so scared, and we came sort of face to face, and he literally looks around and he goes, "Oh, my bad," and he walks away. This man who was ready to get wild, right? Like, felt so bad for us that he changed his mind. And I was like, "Hey, we're not that poor." I was like, "Hey, it's not that. We have a TV, okay?"
I was like, that's scary, though, because you're right. Who knows what he could have done?
Right, yeah. And, you know, when I think back to those stories, it still comes back to, like, why did we move here?
Do you often wonder that? Do you still wonder that?
Yeah, I do. And I've asked my grandma, you know, and all she's just like, "I'm sorry. I am sorry that that happened." But, you know, when people found out of like our status, right, and we didn't have papers, they would be like, "Oh my gosh, wow. Like, where did you come from? Like a war-torn country?" And it was like so embarrassing to be like, "No, Tokyo." Japan. You know, Tokyo Disneyland, lights, camera, action.
Yeah.
You know what?
Amazing food, no street homelessness,
healthcare, you know.
Very little crime. You
so
know.
It does sound wild. And that's why, you know, I always say everyone has their own reasons. And my family did.
How is your mom doing now?
My mom is still the same. She's, she was dealt a rough hand, you know. It's not just schizophrenia. It comes with other things like depression. And she also gets seizures too, you know, a few times a week. And it's hard to figure out the right medication. So, yeah, sometimes I feel like there's like maybe a tiny cloud of sadness around me. And it's because I know always, you know, that my mom is always suffering, even if just a bit. And I get to tour and I get to be on stage and I get to dance, and gosh, just making people laugh and to entertain is it's why I do it, you know. And I think my upbringing and my mother has to do with a lot of that.
Well, she must be really proud of you.
She is, yeah, she is. And yeah, you know, I think if she gets to enjoy my comedy one day, that would be awesome. I'll be playing the stand-up special for her. You know, even if she doesn't understand a lot of the things that I'll be saying, she'll see my gorgeous face that she made. So that was a weird thing to say.
That's beautiful.
yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Atsuko Okatsuka. Her stand-up special called The Intruder is out this Saturday on HBO. Coming up, We'll talk with wordsmith Benjamin Dreyer about Oxford's word of the year, goblin mode. Maybe it's two words of the year. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Goblin mode, that is the word or words of the year, chosen by the Oxford English Dictionary yesterday. Oxford defines it as, quote, a type of behavior which is unapologetically self-indulgent, lazy, slovenly, or greedy, typically in a way that rejects social norms or expectations. I'm sure you can think of a few goblins in your life. Joining me now is Benjamin Dreyer, copy chief of Random House and author of the New York Times bestseller Dreyer's English. Welcome back to Press Play.
Hello, Madeline. How are you?
I'm well. Maybe I'm in goblin mode. I don't know, but I had never heard of this. Had you?
No. As a matter of fact, I hadn't. And of course, when I saw it looming up as being the word, or of course, as you pointed out, words of the year, it's the phrase of the year, yes. I thought that I had literally, and I mean literally, not figuratively, literally, I had literally never heard the phrase at all.
I like that you defined that correctly, that you had literally never heard of the phrase. And I know. So what did you think? Being someone who traffics in words, do you think they made a mistake?
I mean, when I pointed out that I had never heard it before, a lot of my younger and groovier friends said, well, you know, if you hung out on TikTok more, you'd have heard it a lot, which I guess made me happy that I wasn't necessarily hanging out on TikTok a lot. You know, I think that when you're going to go for something like the word or words of the year, you have a really sort of fun opportunity. I won't necessarily say, you know, a responsibility, but you have this fun opportunity to really kind of capture the mood of the moment, the mood of the year. And this one feels to me like a bit of a botch. Not necessarily or not entirely, because it's a fairly obscure, at least from where I'm sitting, phrase that, you know, came from nowhere and will go back there sooner or later, you know, like Chugi.
But I don't even remember that and what that means. I guess.
I don't either. And I'm okay with that. It's like it used up brain cells. but if anything, if you're going to talk about the year in which goblin mode was relevant, I would have gone for last year on that, when many of us were still sort of, you know, hiding at home. And although I have to say, and you can believe it or not, I was, even as I was, you know, still mostly at home, I was very neat, you know, in both my environment and my hygiene. I think that's important to note.
So you've never been in goblin mode? You've never been unapologetically self-indulgent, lazy, slovenly, or greedy?
No, I just don't have that in me. I'm self-indulgent in so many ways. Gosh, I'm self-indulgent in so many ways. That just does not happen to be one of them.
But it kind of does, in a way, capture the way I think people are feeling these days. I mean, when you look at what's happening politically or in the culture, when you look at just what's happening in Twitter, for example, it does sort of feel like a lot of people are in goblin mode.
Yeah. I mean, I've been looking at this, and of course, I like to look at the universe entirely through the lens of what I'm doing at any given moment. I really thought of this
year as...
Didn't
we say you were not self-indulgent? But anyway...
I'm self-important. I'm not self-indulgent.
Got it.
I was thinking of this year as the year of renaissance and reemergence of getting back out into the world, of going to the theater for the first time since, since before the curtain descended, of enjoying being out and about. So maybe I look at, you know, goblin mode being offered up to me as the phrase of the year and wishing it were not so.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, if you were the wizards at Oxford, what would you choose?
Well, I have to say I was very gratified when the Merriam-Webster people came through and named gaslighting as the word of the year, in part because I really think that that's a relevant term to our era. It's also it's a phrase and a concept that I have always loved and I really dote on. And I was particularly amused because just maybe a couple of months ago, I actually got to write a little essay about gaslighting because it's a great term. If it were up to me, if I were picking what I would think would be the word of the year, I think that I would stick with the tried and true. It may be a little bit obvious, but that's okay too. I'd have just gone with insurrection.
Okay, I think that was the word of the year before. But anyway, well, let's keep it alive. Benjamin Dreyer, Random House copy chief and author of the New York Times bestseller Dreyer's English. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.